You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although President Obama may finally be able to close the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center before he leaves office, the conflicts that led to Gitmo's opening in the first place will persist. In recent days, Iraqi troops have fought ISIS militants in an effort to retake the town of Fallujah. In Afghanistan, a U.S. drone strike killed a Taliban leader a little over a week ago. From 2003 to 2010, J. Cale Weston served as a State Department diplomat embedded with Marines and soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, for which he's received the Secretary of State's Medal of Heroism. And now he's written a memoir, The Mirror Test, America at War in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased it has brought Cale Weston to our show today. Hello.
Thank you.
In the first paragraphs of your book, you describe what happened to Marine Corporal Aaron Mankin in Fallujah. Can you tell us about him?
Sure. I think one of the most important stories in the whole book is Aaron Mankin's story. He was a corporal who arrived in Fallujah to work in public affairs. And a few months after arriving, he was very badly wounded and disfigured in a massive roadside bomb incident. And doctors term the period when a patient is figuring out when they're prepared to look in the mirror, the mirror test, and that's the title of the book. And I try and apply it beyond Aaron's personal experience to us as a nation after 15 years of war.
How many Americans in Iran and Iraq have suffered from injuries like his?
Far, far too many. I'm sure it's in the hundreds, if not thousands, if you include amputations. Specifically, Aaron's very eloquent in his own words, which I include at the front of the book, when he decides it's time to look at his new appearance. And what motivates him to do that is the arrival of his younger brother and sister, and he did not want their reaction to basically be his first look into their eyes about what the war did to him.
You cite the number of American dead, almost 7,000, and estimates for Afghans and Iraqis, perhaps as many as a million Iraqis killed. How much do we know about deep injuries, including psychological ones, that can last for the rest of a person's life?
Thank you for asking that question. You're the first person that raised the big number, and I'm sure some of the people who wanted this war will want to debate that. But I think that figure is important because it does get to how war ravages psyches and families. And if you're a mother who lost a son, your life is probably going to end sooner than on average.
And recently it's been suggested that PTSD has been put over another kind of very serious problem, which is moral pain. And maybe moral pain is actually a bigger problem with returning vets than PTSD.
I agree. I think that moral pain, moral injury from these wars is perhaps the hallmark of gray wars, counterinsurgency wars that never had a parade at the end of them and that are still ongoing. I also believe that dealing with moral injury inevitably will take time, and they don't all end in bad outcomes, but when your nation sends you to a war far away and the nation is not mobilized, I think that disconnect between the war front and the home front is tremendous.
Well, the moral pain leads to feelings of guilt that people can't express, and they just suppress them, and that changes the way they relate to everybody else. Few soldiers might not need the kind of care that Mankin has, but can they count on getting the care they do need? Haven't there been a lot of criticism of the treatment that veterans have been receiving from the VA?
There's a lot of criticism. I was in Colorado recently talking to several Marine friends, and I think the VA is getting better based on what they've told me, but I think the best antidote, if there is one, is Marines getting together at reunions, and the current Marine Commandant has prioritized that type of gathering, and it's basically sharing war stories.
There are pictures of soldiers from World War I 100 years ago that look horribly like those of Aaron Mankin now. Have decision makers in war always kind of shut out concerns about things like the personal impact?
Unless it's their son, absolutely. In World War I, the British had a special hospital dedicated to basically the soldiers who were facially disfigured. And if you want to be moved, Google that story. And I think I'm trying to, as a amateur historian, remind us of these patterns and these histories. But politicians vote for war, I think, quickly, and then want to perhaps forget about it too quickly.
You describe a time when Michelle Obama spent time with an injured soldier. Is that unusual?
It was, based on what my friend who told me about the story said. Is his words were, "She lingered." And I think that is unique and special. And I bet the pillow talk between the First Lady and the President has shaped some of those decisions. That's speculation, but I bet based on what he told me, she really understood the pain of war by visiting Bethesda.
My guest is J. Kael Weston, K-A-E-L. His book, The Mirror Test, America at War in Iraq and Afghanistan. You call the Iraq invasion the wrong war. Many critics, including former U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan, argued that the war in Iraq was illegal. Are there other reasons that it was wrong?
It was wrong, in my view, at every level. It was a war of choice. It was not a necessary war. I was based at our mission to the United Nations when we were rolling out the pre-invasion diplomacy.
You were part of the Bush administration?
Yes, I was working with the State Department in the political section of the U.S. mission, and I think the disconnect was that we were under Secretary Powell trying to talk about what we believed was a threat. But ironically, in New York, and people forget already, the debate shifted to the Americans, the Goliath. We weren't overstretched at the time. Our economy hadn't hit rock bottom with the economic meltdown, and the diplomats in New York were less focused on Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction and more focused on the American hyperpower, which is how the French called us at the time. I think that from a moral point of view, war should be a last resort, and I will never believe that Iraq was the last resort.
What about Afghanistan? Was that the right war?
It was a necessary war. I do think it was the right war because right after 9/11, our government asked the Taliban to hand over Osama bin Laden, and they did not. That was a decision they made. So the President of the United States, George Bush, I think, needed to act, and he did.
Do you think that the soldiers who have fought in both of these wars see it that way? Were the ones in Afghanistan see it at the right war, or a more justified war than the ones in Iraq?
Complex question. They should speak for themselves, but in Colorado we had a panel join me, and there were varied views. I think when you lose friends at war, it's hard to step back and maybe be analytical. But those of us who lived through the reddest parts of Iraq understand that when we turn on the TV today, it's hard to judge them as successful.
You say that diplomacy at the UN failed by design. What do you mean by that?
I think a small number of war mongrels, whatever the word is.
Mongers.
Mongrels more accurate, but they wanted the Iraq war, and we got it. It's not that they got it, and I think that the plan to go into Baghdad was ideologically driven, not strategically driven.
CBS News reported that Donald Rumsfeld directed his aides to plan for a strike on Iraq just hours after the 9/11 attacks, and one aide's notes quoted Rumsfeld as saying, "Go massive, sweep it all up, things related and not." Did you see that attitude from the people you were dealing with in government?
I had all the clearances, and I was in New York helping put pressure on the UN inspectors to show that there was some kind of secret WMD program.
And they came on the show. Mm. Now I've forgotten his name.
Hans Blix.
Yes. Mm. He was here. He said, "We went wherever the U.S. told us to go, and there was nothing there, and they could not have cleared it out fast enough, but nobody believed us anyway."
Again, I've lived these wars for 7 years, and I was on the inside, and I had the top secret clearance. And I think we as citizens need to be very honest about the history of that period. There was a steamroll toward war that included a lot of media and a lot of people, and I don't think the diplomacy was taken seriously.
Was there anybody who was arguing that we could take a more measured approach?
I think Secretary Powell did his best.
Although his speech before the UN...
I was in the room when he held up the vial and said anthrax. And a question, I think, to him and to Tony Blair, I think they were the two people that may have been able to slow down the march to war. Secretary Powell has written on this subject, and I think his words speak for themselves. I personally had hoped he would have... not saluted and maybe acted as the chief diplomat rather than the former four-star general, and I'm a big fan of his, but I feel that his reckoning perhaps is ongoing.
You're saying he was being the good soldier?
My personal view, I believe he's a great American, but I almost sense that he was in his soldier mode and not a diplomat mode.
How did you end up getting sent to Iraq, and what did you expect to be doing when you got there?
There were a few dozen of us that went over in that early period in 2003. It was primarily a Defense Department-run operation. Ambassador Bremer, in effect, I think spoke more to Secretary Rumsfeld than to Secretary Powell. I thought I'd be working political issues. It's what I was working on in New York in the Security Council.
Well, you were a diplomat by training.
Yeah, I loved the job. I was negotiating with Chinese, Russian, French diplomats who are all very good at knife fighting in words. But when I got to Baghdad, I was asked to work with the Teamsters, the truckers.
So the work in Iraq that you did was not exactly, didn't fit in with the popular image of the refined, polite diplomat.
No, and I loved it eventually. I had carp along the Tigris with Bassam, who is a character that I introduce in one of the first chapters. And what I think the truckers taught me is that war affects the common person most in any war, and the most wisdom comes from the street, not from the palace.
How much did you know of Arab or Muslim or Sunni Iraqi customs?
Not enough. I confess in the book that I wanted to get over there as quickly as possible. I didn't seek any additional language training. So my first impression in Baghdad and Fallujah was not the best first impression, but I stuck it out, and that's where I think I made up for some of the naivety that I had myself.
Well, were we all naive? Jerry Bremer still defends the decisions that he's made that so many other people feel were disastrous.
I guess I will categorize people who were deployed over there versus those who were deployed behind keyboards. So at least Ambassador Bremer was in Iraq. I think the biggest indictment should be toward those who never left their op-ed keyboard. And so he gets hit a lot for some legitimate reasons, but at least he was in the war zone. And I think the biggest failures came from people who like to complain about what didn't work from far away.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about your experiences there. My guest is J. Cale Weston. His book, The Mirror Test, America at War in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's published by Knopf. We're back with John Cale Weston, who represented the United States for more than a decade as a State Department official. He has written a book called The Mirror Test, America at War in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's published by Knopf. You hold yourself responsible for the deaths of 31 men in a 2011 helicopter crash. What happened? When was the helicopter crash? 2015?
2005.
Yeah.
So it was, we were preparing for an election, and in war, sometimes you only have bad policy options, but there were two courses we could have taken. One was to send Marines to remote polling sites so they would protect the Iraqi voters so that more purple finger images could happen and that the Sunnis would perhaps buy into their government. And I advocated sending Marines to many different locations. And the other option was to keep them focused on two cities. And they were on a mission to go to a place called near Rutba in the far west of Anbar, and one of the helicopters crashed and 31 service members were killed.
The soldiers were intended to protect elections, but weren't Sunnis boycotting the election?
Yeah, and that's the biggest moral injury I'll have for the rest of my life, because the Sunnis were telling me that they were going to boycott. I also had an ambassador and a political counselor, obviously asking me to try and help make sure that Sunnis had the opportunity to vote. But I did think they were going to boycott, and yet I hoped perhaps that the Sunnis would see a future in their government, and I think it's clear they have not.
Well, they were also responding to what had happened in the past. Saddam Hussein had ruled as a Sunni in a Shiite majority country, and I'm sure they were assuming that the Shiites, as a majority, were going to get their revenge.
They were
to some degree. That's what happened as well.
Yeah, and I think they were in as much denial as we were in those early days.
You were in Fallujah during the second battle near the end of 2004. Why would a State Department official accompany Marines to a combat zone?
Because Marines wanted policy to match their sacrifice, and our government believed that the political plan needed to guide where Marine tactics led them, and my job was to work with the commanding generals and all the way down to corporals to try and get Fallujah rebuilt after the biggest battle of the Iraq War. And Iraqis honestly would rather have a civilian in the room than just a room full of uniforms and weapons.
How close to combat were you?
The Marines protected me, and being out with the Marines, I had more than a few close calls. But those adrenaline moments were not what I wanted to focus on in my book.
Have you been following what's happening in Fallujah now? Are Americans at all involved in this new push?
I'm Kale al-Faluji. That's what they called me. So my Iraqi hometown is being cleared, or whatever the right word is, for the nth time. And it's a tragedy all around. It's a tragedy fundamentally for the Iraqi people, and it's a tragedy for our efforts as well.
Although it doesn't get a lot of attention in the press. You think that we've moved on to other things, mostly, I guess, the current election and Donald Trump?
Yes, and I think war fatigue should only be defined by Iraqis, not by Americans. This idea that we're tired of war really irks me.
You weren't living in the Green Zone in Baghdad. Where were you living?
In Fallujah, I was downtown in the Civil Military Operations Center, and that was where I became very good friends with a number of Marines, and it was the Alamo.
Now, Fallujah is just 20 miles or so from Baghdad?
A bit more.
But it's pretty close.
Oh, it's very close.
Did you have much interaction with troops from other members of the coalition, like the British?
Limited at the time. I had more interaction with them in Afghanistan and Helmand, but the coalition in Iraq was a coalition, jokingly, people referred to as the bullied and the bribed, whereas in Afghanistan it was a more genuine coalition.
How about private contractors? You have a photo of a Marine tribute to the Blackwater contractors killed in Fallujah in March 2004. What did the U.S. troops make of the private contractors who got involved in scandals along the way?
It was controversial. If you're a 19-year-old Lance Corporal and you're at the gym with a Blackwater contractor who makes, 10 times as much as you do, there's a certain level of friction. And I opted not to have the Blackwater team stay in Anbar, mainly because I felt they were, I think, at about $10 million a year, too expensive, and I felt more safe with the Marines and their convoys. But there was friction. That said, I think contractors, with Blackwater, had a role, and it was a controversial role, and we all know how badly it ended up with the shooting in Baghdad. But when your country goes to war, but not your nation goes to war, you're going to have to hire people to help. And I think
you make a distinction there. Your country,
we are not a nation at war. If your nation's at war, you're mobilized. The pain is more widely shared. My dad and uncles were in Vietnam. My grandfather and great uncle were in World War II. There was a draft, and these have been wars where our country has a remote sense that there's wars going on, but we're not a nation at war.
Whatever the damage or injury in a given location, soldiers had to press on, proceed with their mission. Did that mean you had to deal with what remained? The Iraqi infrastructure had collapsed.
It had, and my role was to work the political side and to help show that we were not just about leveling half of Fallujah, but trying to rebuild it after the military operation ended. And that's where I became very close to a number of Iraqis.
Were we thinking about state building at the time?
Oh, not only state building, we were city building, we were neighborhood building. I tell people that the best city builders in the world right now are captains and majors who spend three or four tours going to city council meetings every day in Iraq and building infrastructure.
You describe work at a potato factory that had been converted to a morgue. What did you do there?
I observed, and that is a very hard part of the Iraq experience for me, but I only had that window into the horror of war for a couple of days, and I think often about the Marines who were doing it every day. We had to clear bodies and move them out of the city, and the potato factory was a reefer, a cool place to store the bodies before we were able to bury them.
Now, when we started the war against Iraq, Vice President Cheney said, or somebody else up there said, that the Iraqis would strew rose petals before the American troops. How were you? Did you have much contact with the Iraqis, and what were their feelings about what was going on at this time?
I had daily contact with the Iraqis. I think, if anything, my book's trying to introduce Iraqis front and center, because when you go to war, you need to see the war from their point of view. And so I met with them in Fallujah every week at the city council meeting, and tribal and religious leaders every other day.
Were they as grateful to the Americans as the U.S. media portrayed them?
Not in Fallujah, not in the Sunni lands, because, again, we had completely turned their world upside down. We had removed them from power, and we had become ineffective occupiers. What they wanted was us to at least be effective at what we were doing. They wanted us to at least be professional at what we were doing. They wanted us to at least understand where we were and what those dynamics were. And those are all very reasonable expectations if you invade a country.
My guest is J. Cale Weston. His book, The Mirror Test, America at War in Iraq and Afghanistan, is published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What about Afghanistan? The U.S. had already been at war there since October 2001 when you arrived. What condition was the U.S. effort there?
It had been neglected. It was a neglected war front. At the time, all of us who had been in Iraq, you know, had a few of our friends who were over in Afghanistan, and they called it the Forgotten War.
Even though it was the right war.
The right war in the original, I think, just war, if I guess you can apply that term to any war. And yet the Afghans, by and large, wanted us there. So that was a huge advantage we had in Afghanistan.
You'd worked with the Marines in Iraq, and you were working with the U.S. Army in Afghanistan. How did that compare?
I'm the son of a soldier and the grandson of a soldier, but I will always consider my tribe to be the Marine Corps, because if you're in a very hard, dangerous situation, the U.S. Marine Corps is good company.
The U.S. has made extensive use of drones in Afghanistan and Pakistan, more than in Iraq. What makes Iraq different?
Actually, the technology hadn't advanced to be armed yet. The early days in Iraq, over a decade ago, they were basically metallic eyes peering from the sky. They didn't yet have the missiles attached to them. The Beltway Bandits managed to sell a lot of products to our government when there's a big bucks to be made. So by the time I got to Afghanistan, the technology had actually improved, where they were well-armed and increasingly being used.
There have been reports of post-traumatic stress disorder among drone operators. What did you see of the effects on civilians in the areas that were being attacked? Were people looking up in the sky all the time to see if drones were coming?
The kids were fearful, and one of my Afghan friends told me that, in a half-joking way, that when Afghan parents want to scare their children, they'll say, you know, go to bed or the drones will come after you. Ooh. And it's, I think, a pretty bad statement about, again, what words do Afghans associate with us. Drones is a big one, and we should think about that.
You've described yourself as paying blood money to families who lost people in U.S. operations. Why call it blood money? The U.S. government doesn't call it that.
I'm a lot more blunt than our government.
What does the government call it?
Solatia payments or condolence payments. There's some interesting legalities, which I get into a little bit as well, which is when you pay money, you didn't want to admit guilt. And our lawyers obviously didn't want to be in a position where we were saying we killed your son, or we, you know, accidentally blew up the compound where your grandmother was. But we at least, and again, we at least tried to do something to ease the pain. It will never come close, because I believe $1 million wouldn't ease that pain. But unlike some examples in the past, our better instincts in the form of money did help some families.
We're giving them a few thousand dollars.
Which is not a lot. When our dead die, it's about $500,000 tax-free. So if you have a member of your neighborhood who died in the war, we put a price on our KIA, about $500,000. If you're an Afghan, the max we paid was about $5,000. I was in rooms when the sons of three Fallujah leaders took our blood money, and I could tell in their face, and there's a photo in the book, it still grabs me. They did not want to take our money, but they had to, because they were now responsible for their families.
There's also a photo of a Lance Corporal in Afghanistan, Joshua Bernard, who was photographed by Associated Press photographer Julie Jacobson. What happened to him?
That's a hard story. He was a Marine in Nowzad District and was killed by an RPG that horrifically mangled his legs. And she was a photographer who I had met a couple weeks before, and we used to talk about Colorado and Utah, and she took the photo, and it became a controversy as to whether or not it should be released.
Both the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, and the Ed Bernard's family opposed the release.
They did.
Why?
I don't think I'll understand why our government should oppose it. I could understand why the family would oppose it, because he was their son who loved literature. And I believe we were still in the mode officially where our government didn't think people could handle the most horrific images from the war, and I think they were wrong.
So you think that if Americans saw more of what suffering really looks like, it might affect public opinion and decision makers?
You know, in Vietnam, the combat photographers used to have their dispatches in Ladies' Home Journal. We ought to think about that, and the fact that people who subscribed to Ladies' Home Journal were actually reading about Vietnam. It's a very different frame than what we have today. I believe that the American people can handle tough news, but I don't think it should be filtered.
Both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have endorsed more hawkish policies than President Obama. Trump is far more hawkish. Do you see an end to war in the next 4 years?
No, but I think we've got an incredibly important decision to make about who the next commander-in-chief should be.
I found an interesting quote from Mark Twain. God created war so that Americans would learn geography. There are still many Americans who could not find Iraq or Afghanistan on a map. Last October, President Obama announced that U.S. troops would remain in Afghanistan into 2017. Is anybody you knew still there?
Oh, in the wars? Oh, yeah. There are people who have experiences that are now being picked because they were in Anbar 10 years ago or in Afghanistan. So the deployments for some of my friends who are Marines or in the Special Operations Forces are now over 5, 6, 7.
You've made a point of keeping in touch with veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. Do you see any differences between the ones who were in Iraq and the ones who were in Afghanistan when they returned home?
I think all of us fall in love with Afghanistan and the Afghans more so than Iraq. I should let them speak for themselves, but the people, the landscape, it's truly a magical place, and they're a tough, resilient people. I think Iraq was occupation. I think Afghanistan was different than occupation. So I do think people, I'm generalizing, have maybe a more positive view toward what it's like to be in a country where most of the people basically wanted you there, at least in the early period. Iraq, in the West, where I was, they never did.
I saw a documentary in which a vet said that when he came home after having really gone through this horrendous experience, he turned on the TV and there was President Bush joking around about the weapons of mass destruction, picking up the rug and saying, oh, they're not there, looking under his desk saying, oh, they're not there. And he felt that that really demeaned his experience. Did you find other soldiers felt that way?
Not only did I find soldiers, I felt that way. I was in Baghdad when that ridiculous gathering that happens every year in Washington had a spoof, including the president's dog Barney, about not finding the WMD. And it's not just the president, it was the establishment that were all laughing. It was Nancy Pelosi and it was Mitch McConnell. So I call this journey in these 7 years for what they are. And we as Americans and as citizens, I think, need to remember, how could people laugh about what was considered the primary reason to go to war?
In a Daily Beast article over 3 years ago, you call for a public debate over U.S. policy. And in a New York Times op-ed last weekend, you noted that Memorial Day rarely serves as a time to reflect on the policies that have led to war deaths. What kinds of debate are we having? And in fact, is there any debate?
It's not a debate proportionate to the United States of America. It's not a debate proportionate to the blood-red cost of 15 years of warfare. It's an overly simplified debate. It's a debate based on fear. It's not a debate based on wisdom.
President Obama just became the first sitting president to visit Hiroshima. Do you think it'll take 70 or more years for a president to visit the places that we have affected so greatly in the Middle East?
I think before any president arrives, I hope there will be an opportunity for our troops to go back and walk the streets where they lost friends and to walk the streets where they met and befriended Afghans and Iraqis. And perhaps one day an American president can go to Iraq, not in the middle of the night.
We just had a president go to Vietnam. And American GIs have been going to Vietnam a lot in recent years.
We've talked about that at reunions. You know, when will be the day that the situation allows for never resolution, but some kind of, I don't think there's a word for it, return. Return in a way that isn't in a military sense.
J. Cale Weston's book, The Mirror Test, America at War in Iraq and Afghanistan, is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being on our show.
I greatly appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.